plug it cord all the way in.
Or you gotta stick it all the way in.
I have to go. It's hell. Show business is hell now. What are you going to make me do now?
I don't know.
Well, be careful.
I don't know which is our program here. I got to... Go ahead.
You want to...
You do the Bob Dylan piece.
You want to...
Do the Bob Dylan piece you're so proud of.
Ain't no you sitting.
Welcome to the Tom Dupree Show. This week, joining us, Adarsh Meshru, Mike Johnson, our host, Tom Dupree, and our conversation starter this week is, did you know that 70% of the stocks in the NASDAQ are down 20% from their 52-week high? What you all have to say about that?
Well, first of all, I'll say that this is Chet Atkins playing with Jerry Reed. And Jerry Reed was a very well-known picker in Nashville, was, you know, made popular by the movie Smokey and the Bandit, the song Eastbound and Down. But what people didn't realize about Jerry Reed was the incredible guitar player he was. That's why Chet Atkins took him under his wing, because Chet didn't mess around with anybody but pickers, you know. That was who he liked. And he was a guy who got the attention of Chet Atkins early. So that's what this song is, them performing live. And you just didn't have Chet Atkins hanging out with people that couldn't pick.
Who were some of the other ones? So Chet Atkins. So,
well, Mark Knopfler.
Mark Knopfler, that's who I was thinking of.
Steve Warner.
And a lot of them are finger picker players.
That's what they were. Yeah. And anyway, so that was something I pick up these things on YouTube, and that's not a recorded thing that you can find anywhere. But Jerry Reed, you wouldn't have thought he was that good of a guitar player. Just, he seems like a crazy redneck, you know, but he was quite good.
Absolutely.
So, all right, guys, what do y'all want to jump into today?
One of the really interesting things in the last, you know, several months, it's been what's been going on with tech, in the tech sector. More explicitly, more specifically, small to mid-sized tech growth companies. And so the NASDAQ, the index, is a tech index. And if you look over the last 52 weeks, a little over 70% of the stocks in the NASDAQ are down 20% or more from their 52-week high. And even more dramatic is 50% or more, or 41% are down 50% or more from their 52-week high. So,
and it's not, and we still think of the stock market as being close to an all-time high, but there's been a lot of carnage in areas that are not necessarily, well, but tech is huge, so a lot of people are feeling the pain on things like this.
Yes, and it's the large tech companies which have buoyed the broad index. You know, they have held up, you know, pretty well, generally speaking. They've held up well. So when you just look at the NASDAQ or, you know, a more broad-based index, you don't realize what's been going on under the surface. You know, one of the funds that really came to prominence last year were Cathie Wood's ARK funds. You know, one of them's the Innovation ETF, which are more speculative, growth-oriented types of companies. And that was the, especially in 2020, that was a big star of 2020. And the fund attracted massive amounts of money, that people chasing yield. It wasn't a new fund in 2020. It had been around for some time, but it started making headlines, which made headlines, which made more headlines, and it attracted a lot of money. And you had a massive outperformance through the early part of 21 relative to the NASDAQ. But what's interesting now is the NASDAQ is even or slightly higher than what the ARK funds had done over the last 3 years. We were talking yesterday, you know, it's a classic example of reversion to the mean, you know, where you have a longer-term average and you have this outlier event or outlying performance, and it just naturally kind of gravitates more towards the long-term averages.
Right.
And, you know, what's interesting is that the indexes, you know, your NASDAQ, S&P, they are market cap weighted indexes, which means that the larger companies have a higher weightage in the index. And given, you know, how 401ks and such invest, there's more and more money that keeps going into these indexes, and they primarily flow into some of these large companies. So just looking at the index can be extremely misleading, you know, when it comes to what the market is doing, even though the indexes, you know, represent the market. So, you know, the ARK fund became a victim of its own success,
right,
so to speak. And we've seen this happen in the past. We saw something similar happen with your value funds, you know, over a decade ago, where there were star managers who did extremely well for a number of years. And then everyone wanted to invest in their fund. So all of a sudden, they had all this money that they didn't know where to put, and hence their returns suffered. There's also a mention of Warren Buffett. You know, he had written back in 1996 that when Berkshire was a much smaller company, it was much easier for them to outperform the market. But as they became bigger and bigger, their outperformance has not been as, you know, stellar as it used to be. In fact, since 1996, Berkshire Hathaway has outperformed the S&P by only 0.5% annualized, which means that...
Still a big...
Yes.
...feat.
Still a big feat, exactly, yes. You know, money managers tend to become victims of their own success. And in the case of ARK, they were investing in companies which were not very large in the first place. And as their assets grew, so at its peak, ARK managed $54 billion amongst various funds. But their biggest fund is the Innovation Fund, as Mike mentioned. So they started owning bigger and bigger pieces of these small companies. And when it came to when it came time to buy, they were influencing the price on the way up. And once they had to sell something, just given their ownership in the company, the stock prices, you know, suffered as they had to sell large amounts of shares.
You know, you look at the ARK fund and then compare it to a fund from 30 plus years ago, the Fidelity Magellan Fund with Peter Lynch. So you had a fund, two different funds with kind of star managers buying things that are, you know, in the news type of holdings. One of them outperformed for years and years, and that would be the Magellan Fund. The other fund really had some short outperformance, but then has dropped back in a big way. And I think that when the market was back in the 80s and 90s, when the Magellan Fund was really putting its numbers up, there was a greater depth and more liquidity and bigger representation throughout than today. Today, the market, to me, reeks a lot more of speculation and disinformation. People don't really know what they're investing in some ways, like, say, Peter Lynch did. I think we've had a long period of a bull market that people can feel like they can invest in just about anything, not really do their research. Whereas during the time of Peter Lynch, late 80s, early 90s, as the Magellan Fund was really starting to take off, you know, they did their research. They would buy mid-sized companies, other kinds of companies, but there seemed to be a more of a diversity of kinds and types of companies. Wasn't just a tech fund, Magellan, yet it was outperforming in a big way. And today, it seems different. It doesn't seem as substantial to me. And this is based on a lot of years of examining these things. That's just, I mean, you know, Peter Lynch wrote some excellent books on investing. One up on Wall Street. That was one of them. I can't think. There was about four or five of them. Quite good. Good for anybody who wants to read about the investment process.
You know, and that is true. So Peter Lynch did extremely well. Although his term as the head of the, as the portfolio manager of the Magellan Fund was not that long. So you could argue that had he stuck around for another decade or two, his outperformance may not have been the same. He did really well. You know, he started becoming famous, I guess, in the late 70s, and he was at the Magellan Fund for only 9 years, I think, and then he retired. It was a private fund before that, and then it was open to the public for a shorter time. I'll have to go back, but that's what I recommend.
I know he was there in 87 when the market meltdown occurred.
Right. Prior to Peter Lynch, there was this guy named Gerald Tsai, who T-S-A-I, who had sent an article not that long ago. He was the Cathie Wood of the 60s. Right. And in the
go-go stocks.
The go-go stocks, yes. So there was a similar period when, you know, some of these stocks did extremely well. And this guy was the star manager and then collected assets. And then a decade later, you know, the fund had really suffered because all these stocks dropped.
But the interesting thing, just specifically on the ARK funds, you know, we're talking about it right now because of the poor performance over the last, you know, roughly 52 weeks. But you look at the asset flow. So most investors in the fund were getting in on the way up to the peak or near the peak. So it was money chasing returns. But over the last 5 years, it's averaged a 31% annualized return. quite good.
Yeah.
But very, very few investors in the fund have
gotten that.
Have gotten that.
Because and the same thing happened in the Magellan Fund. People would trade in and out of it.
Right. Right.
I would also say that today, because of social media, information and knowledge about, you know, star managers like Cathie Woods spreads much faster. So back in the 80s, it probably took a long time for the average person to realize who Peter Lynch was and then start investing. So his pace of gathering new assets was probably much slower. But here, you know, in just the span of a few months, word spread. Everyone knew about Cathie Woods, you know, through Facebook and such. And
I don't know. It could spread pretty fast back then, too, despite the limited media outlets. People were able to gain information quickly.
But I think it's the infrastructure in place now, too, to actually purchase, make the purchase.
Right.
You know, if you're a retail investor and you read a blurb on Facebook of Cathie Woods, you click on the article. Oh, I want some of that. 2 minutes later, boom, yeah, you're on your app, yeah. No cost, and you own it. And so all those funds, just, you know, everything has been sped up. You know, between, you know, what we saw in 2020, the drop and the move back up, and now, you know, the drop in tech, it seems like everything's moving faster and faster.
Right.
But it
just seems that way.
But we've had, I can't tell you how many conversations in the last 2 years, you know, of people that are investing, you know, almost exclusively in high growth, very aggressive types of, you know, be it an ETF or they're picking individual stocks, you know, a concentrated portfolio in this particular sector. And, you know, it's like, that's fine. You know, when it's good, it's good. But just realize when things start to turn, it can get a lot uglier than you think it will. Plus, let's say, you know, 4 years ago, you had a balanced portfolio between the various sectors and you just had a nominal allocation to tech, you know, this sector. Well, that grew to an outsized portion just because of the growth. And now you're feeling it more whenever it's, you know, on its way down. So it's – you always have to be disciplined with the portfolio, and you know that's what they call style drift. You know, it happens in funds, you know, where you just let a portfolio drift, and you know if something goes up, well it's a higher percentage, and there is some merit to that, but you also need to be disciplined on taking profits, seeing where value is, possibly allocating more funds to a particular area. So you always have to monitor and not let it get put on autopilot.
I think, you know, going back to Cathie Wood, I think she is extremely smart, she's also, you know, her timing was excellent. She started the fund, you know, the NASDAQ went nowhere for almost 17 years after the tech bubble in 2000. So 2000 to 2000, early 2017, NASDAQ sideways. So she started the fund just when, you know, interest in tech stocks was starting to revive again. Her prime clientele is millennials, mm-hmm. You know, youngsters. So she talks the language that they understand. The fund itself is very transparent. Every day they tell you what they've bought and sold. You don't have to wait for 3 months. And I think they do a lot of research because on their website there is a lot of research. It's just that, you know, these things go in trends, you know. So it just so happened that over the last few years, this sector of the market was doing well, and now it may not do well for a while. But I don't know if that negates the fact that, you know, for what she does, she is pretty good.
Well, and it's not to say that it won't do well moving forward. It could.
I don't know. It, it's going to go sideways for a while because tech is like anything else. It gets expensive, and then the air has to come out of it for a while.
Sure, sure. And I get the question is how long that while is. You know, if you're 20 years old, well, I mean, you always it's always opportunity cost. You know, you're always weighing what you're giving up during that time. But again, the to me, the biggest takeaway here is, you know, not to let your investment portfolio get overly concentrated in one particular area where you are essentially making a bet on her ability or a particular sector or a particular small stock. And so that's be disciplined, be careful, and, you know, do take a long-term approach. But, you know, this is one area that we've talked to a lot of people about over the last couple of years and just kind of raised the red flag for them.
Well, and it gets back to what you've said before, Mike, which is ask questions and make sure you know what you own and make sure the person that's advising you knows what you own and why. It's time for a break. You're listening to the Tom Dupree Show with Adarsh Meshrew and Mike Johnson, in addition to Tom Dupree. We will be back in just a few minutes with more. Stay tuned.
I went a hunting them nightclubs looking for a place to play. Well, I thought my picket would set them on fire, but nobody wanted to hire a little guitar. Well, I nearly about starved to death down in Memphis. I run out of money and luck, so I bummed me a ride down to Macon, Georgia on an overloaded boat and truck. I bummed on down to Panama City, started checking out some of them all-night bars, hoping I could make myself a dollar making music on my guitar. I got the same old story, them all night here. There ain't no room around here for a guitar man. Well, son, I slept in hobo jungle. I bought 1,000 miles of track till I found myself in Mobile, Alabama, and a club they call Big Jack's. A little four-piece band was jamming, so I took the little guitar and I said, I showed them what a band would sound like with a swinging little guitar man. Show 'em, chillin'.
Welcome back to the Tom Dupree Show. Joining us, Adarsh Meshrew, Mike Johnson, and our host, Tom Dupree.
It's another song by Jerry Reed called Guitar Man, which was a hit for him. And evidently, I've heard this story from a guy named Otis Gibbs. It was on the radio. Elvis Presley had been making these movies out west that were not good and wanted to get back into, you know, recording, and he wanted to go to Nashville. He wanted to kind of do country, and he heard this song on the radio and says, I got to cut that album, that song. So he does. He goes and cuts the song, and he gets all these session musicians, and nobody could get the guitar piece right. And they're sitting around. It's in Nashville, and they say, somebody called Jerry Reed. So they had to go find him on the Cumberland River. He was fishing. He comes in, you know, he's all scraggly and everything. Elvis liked everybody to dress up in his sessions. And he gets the guitar lick, right? Because it's his song, right? And so Elvis is going nuts, loving the song, you know, does a good job with it. And then they come up to Jerry Reed and say, well, you know, there's a rule, because Colonel Tom Parker was the guy that managed Elvis's affairs, and he said, whenever Elvis cuts a song, you got to give up half of your publishing rights to it. And they've already cut the song, And Jerry Reed says, I'll tell you what, you be the guy that go over and tell Elvis that we're not doing his deal the way he loves the song. And so Jerry got it his way, you know. Of course, Elvis had no idea because the Colonel managed everything for him. But Jerry didn't have to give up any of his publishing rights, which, you know, meant that song went from being a really good song to a moonshot. And, you know, he had a great career. He was just an incredible guy. Oil jumps to 7-year highs amid supply concerns and drone strikes. Well, one of the things that I've been talking about with oil is that, to me, everything has set up for oil to be a bull market for some time to come, because all the supply is under attack. Nobody wants to be in the business. Nobody wants to be a driller. And consequently, it's building that wall of worry that could drive the price a lot higher. And if the cost of oil goes higher, you're going to see the cost of food go higher, because the key input into food production are energy costs. It has to follow. I mean, I don't see how you can have energy costs going higher and food costs go down. I just don't see how you do it. So, to me, these are things that are perched for bull markets.
Right. So, I mean, when you think about what happened in the oil market specifically, oil prices peaked in the year 2008 when oil had hit $147 a barrel. And since then, they have never gone back to that level. When they peaked in 2008, there was a fear of there not being enough oil. You know, we were talking about peak oil.
And they didn't really have shale yet.
Yes, they did not. Shale and horizontal
drilling,
fracking. So technology really helped bring down the price of oil and gas. I mean, you could argue that there was also some sort of, a bubble at that point, perhaps a little bit, or speculation that oil prices were going. I remember in 2008, people were talking about 200 oil, and it peaked right at 147.
All vertical drilling.
Right. So 12 years later, we found back in March of 2020, we found ourselves in at a point where oil prices went negative briefly in the futures market. And in the intermediate term, there were, you know, moments when prices went up again, they would come down. So being an investor in oil and gas was not really a good, it wasn't a good place to be over the last decade. And consequently, oil and gas companies also stopped investing as much. When oil prices, you know, in 2014, they went back up briefly over 100. At that point, you know, there was still some incentive to drill. But since then, 2014 onwards, we went through a 6-year period where there were mass bankruptcies in the space. Prices were continuously under downward pressure. And only the best companies, the ones that maintained some sort of discipline, you know, survived through this entire period. And now these companies are focusing, their balance sheets are good, which means that, you know, when oil prices go up, they are not bringing in more supply just to, you know, pay down their debts or whatever. They're waiting, you know, so they're like, okay, our balance sheets are in good shape. If oil prices go up, we'll still drill the same amount. We may pay a higher dividend. So
the drilling today is less speculative because they have way more information about the geological formations in which they're drilling.
Right. So the industry is overall in a good place. At the same time, for various reasons, supply is going to be constrained going forward, not just the companies themselves not bringing on more supply, but just regulation-wise, it's going to be hard for, to get permits and things to drill more oil. And all the estimates show that, demand for oil is going to remain strong and even increase in the emerging world for some time to come. We are not going to stop using oil. So as you said, all the conditions are ripe for there to be, a revival in the space. And Mike's got this chart here. The energy sector as a percentage of the S&P 500 in 2010, energy was 10% of the S&P 500. In 2020, energy dropped to just 2% of the S&P 500, which means that, valuations went down. People just stopped investing in that sector. And today we are at 3%, so we're not much higher from there. So it is conceivable that, there may be more interest. Of course, big institutions for ESG reasons, which stands for environmental, social, governance reasons, may hesitate from investing in the oil and gas space. But that does not mean that these companies can't be profitable, can't generate cash flow and, pay that cash flow to the remaining shareholders, whoever's remaining.
And it's, you look at, let's say the transportation of energy, of natural gas, like the pipeline companies. historically, so Kinder Morgan is one. They're the largest natural gas pipeline company in North America. They had more direct exposure to the price of the commodity. And as you're talking, how companies have evolved over the last 6-7 years, Kinder Morgan, this is not a recommendation for Kinder Morgan. We're just familiar with it. They've reduced their ties to the price of the commodity itself. It's the transportation of, in their case, natural gas. It's the movement of that. And you've seen that in a lot of the different companies. But again, circling back, how this ties in with tech, you could potentially have a long run where energy does quite well. You had a long run when tech did quite well. Stay disciplined when you're investing. Look for the opportunities, but always stay disciplined and not let one particular area get overweight, which can – if you take a long-term view – and that's easy to say. If you take a long-term view on something, well, you can ride out anything. Well, that's true as long as something doesn't go bankrupt. But what you have to do is know yourself as an investor. And if you're concentrated in one particular area and that area drops and your portfolio drops a higher percentage, know your if you want to call it risk tolerance, that's a term that's thrown around, but you do need to know thyself. So you need to be invested properly for your goals, for your emotional makeup, and you have to know why it's in the portfolio. Darsh, Tom, we've clearly laid out, why we're seeing opportunities in energy right now. And that's something we do for our clients regularly. Why are we investing a particular way? Communication is key. But it is interesting. We're looking at the sector allocation of the S&P 500. You know what's been the most consistent? Just waiting, utilities.
Yeah.
3%, 3%, 3%, 3%.
Yeah.
It's a very consistent overall weighting to the sector.
Now, we've owned, which one?
PP&L.
Yeah. Still own it, don't mm-hmm. we?
Yeah, we've owned several in the past. We still have one. But, you know, like with anything, you have to know what you own and why you own it. Sometimes it could be, you know, there are specific things about this company that you can't get anywhere else and you own the company. There are other times when you might own the sector, but everything has to have a reason for being in there. It can't just be, you know, hey, we need the market in there, you know, sort of, you know, so now you can have a thesis of, I want the market in there. That can be a thesis. But you need to know why you want,
sure,
the, quote unquote, the market in there. So everything should be thought out.
If you want the market in there, basically you're betting on the momentum of the average investor to buy into the market and not do research on specific companies, because those sorts of calls are not necessarily researched in terms of being a business call. So.
Yep. So it's interesting looking at how things ebb and flow, the various sectors in the market, how you have these speculative bubbles. And we're looking at tech. Well, what's happened in the last 5 years, you would naturally expect things like that to happen when your risk-free rate is zero. You're going to have more risk-taking happen. And when the risk-free rate gets, you can argue, artificially low, or just it is low is the fact, when that happens, then that's when you get these bubbles. Because, you know, cryptocurrencies, NFTs, all these different things, It distorts the valuations of everything when your risk-free rate is nothing.
Yeah. You know, investing is always done as a relative exercise given the market conditions that are being presented to you. You can say, well, the market's expensive, the market's cheap, the market's fair valued. But at any given time, there is going to be something relatively better valued than everything else. The job of someone who does what we do, and really anybody who invests money for their own account or for somebody else's, is to detect where those places of relative value are and then determine, you know, can I live with this? So one might say right now, given that we just read earlier, that 70% of tech companies are down 20%, 41% of them are down 50%. One would think, that's where the value is. Is it true? Which ones of those tech companies are really solid and can be depended upon to throw off earnings? Could you buy in here? Or which ones were simply riding a wave with very little earnings and are down 50%, but they're going to be down 90%? You know, because that's this, you know, And we got to be willing to jump in there and look and say, you know, what's really cheap here? That's how we found out about aircraft leasing. Because this guy came in here. His name started with an F. He gave us a list of like 20 stocks. And he said he wanted to buy all of them. 19 of them were just junk. But Adarsh said this one stock, Genesis Leasing, he said, this is interesting. That's how we got into aircraft leasing. And it's because we did the research. And we worked off a list that a guy basically got out of Forbes or some magazine that was, you know, pretty much a bunch of stocks that were never going to do anything, like a bunch of racehorses that just didn't amount to anything. You know, they weren't bred to run. Well, this one thing, we made a lot of money off that one stock and then other successor stocks. But it's because we paid attention and did the research.
So, I mean, as you said, you know, it's you have to know what you own, because if you don't have conviction in what you own, then you know, then your emotions are bound to get the better of you when, you know, things get rocky, which they often do, you know, in the markets. Mm-hmm. So knowing what you own is important, and you know, doing your research is important.
Yeah, and being willing to act when you know that your research is telling you something that your eyes believe what your mind is telling you. That is a really good feeling when you've come up with something and you know it's a good deal and you found it. That is satisfying. That's why, that's like stepping up to a golf ball and hitting the thing 200 yards straight down the fairway with a fairway wood. In the contact, you don't even feel it. I've only had that happen to me a few times because I'm not that good of a golfer. But the feeling of doing it, it's a great feeling. It's the same thing with investing.
All right, let's see where Jerry Reed is. He is, there he is. Well, that's a wrap for this week. I think there's been a common theme, and it's know what you own. Have somebody advise you that does the research and has conviction.
What do you own?
I've got somebody advising me that has conviction, whose voice just was heard. Thank the Lord above.
I have conviction, except when it comes to your portfolio.
Well, it's always a slippery slope, isn't it?
Yeah,
you've been listening
yours
to
is the
Tom
one
Dupree
I screw
Show.
Up.
We hope you've learned something this week. Our guide is to educate, guide, and empower. We will talk to you next week.